This is on. Okay. So you guys got conflicting messages. At the end of last lecture, Professor Laflamme said everyone should have a question. And then I talked to him yesterday, and he said, "Oh, we've had too many questions." Not quite. But despite the fact that everyone should have a question, I want to treat this a little differently today. I want to give something of a formal lecture for about 30 minutes. And the reason I want to do this is, as opposed to bringing a tomato in here like I did last time, I sort of wish I had a stone so that I could tell you that I want to kill two birds with one stone today. And the two birds are this. I want to tell you more about the program, and then I will indeed give you a chance to ask lots of questions. That's one bird, tell you more about the program. The other bird that I want to tell you about is some of the technical work that my group of guys here have been working on, and which is crucial for the program. But I think to understand the program better, the interpretational program, it's probably good to have some of the technical background as well, and not just airy-fairy philosophical discussions on what is the meaning of truth and so forth. So that's the other bird that I want to kill. So let me lay into this. A good bit of what I've been talking about is based on the idea that this thing called the Born rule, rather than being a theorem in quantum mechanics. So for instance, if one starts with Gleason's assumptions, I don't know if you talked about Gleason's theorem in this course, but very often people try to derive the Born rule. Most foundational programs want to derive the Born rule, which means that they want to take another set of axioms that don't have the Born rule in it and then find the Born rule as a theorem. So there's something famous in quantum foundations called Gleason's theorem. That is one possible derivation of the Born rule. The many-worldsers, is there going to be a lecture from a many-worlds person here? Okay. A big part of their project is trying to derive the Born rule from their point of view of quantum mechanics. And the decoherence guys like Wojciech Zurek, some piece of his program is deriving the Born rule. Since we quantum Bayesians are always the outlier, I'll tell you that I don't want to derive the Born rule. I want to take this thing called the Born rule actually as the foundation of the theory and derive the rest of the structure of the theory from this axiom. So from our point of view, this is not something to be derived, but something to be taken as basic. So what I'm going to tell you now is based on that idea of wanting to take this as a foundation for quantum mechanics, and then from taking this thing in some modified form, deriving the structure of quantum mechanics back out of it. The reason for all of this is this point of view about probabilities that you may have read about in the paper, that probability theory is a normative theory. That it's not actually, probability theory itself doesn't tell you which probabilities you should use. All it says is, if you have this probability for this, and this probability for this, and this probability for something else, then they should, all these probabilities should be related according to some relations that are the axioms of probability theory. So with that in mind, and knowing that quantum states, for those of you who were at yesterday's lecture, knowing that quantum states are so much like probability theory, or so much like probabilities, it suggests that perhaps one should think of the Born rule in a different way than usual. Particularly, I'd like to make the claim that it's not a law of nature. Rather, the Born rule is something you should strive for. Now, what on earth could that mean? That it's not a law of nature, because certainly it's a deep part of quantum mechanics. What I'm trying to express is something along these lines, that this thing called the Born rule is not like the other laws of physics that we know. So if one thinks of Newton's equation connecting force and acceleration, F equals ma, as a law of nature, the claim I want to make is that the Born rule is not like that. It's not like the laws for the electromagnetic field, and it's not like the laws of the gravitational field in this sense. If you are an electric field, if you can imagine being an electric field, the idea is that you must satisfy these equations. If you don't satisfy these equations, then you're something else. You're not an electromagnetic field. If you're a gravitational field, then you must satisfy these equations. If you don't satisfy these equations, you're not a gravitational field. I feel really silly with this thing on. Do I look silly? I do feel like the infomercial guy, the guy who does the chop, chop, chop thing. I mean, especially saying crap like this. You know I'm trying to sell you something. So I want to say it's not like that. Rather, if you're looking for an analogy to what the Born Rule is, I think a better analogy comes from the Bible, the Ten Commandments. And how is that different? Well, okay, there's a commandment that says, thou shalt not kill. See how it's different than the statement of electromagnetic fields? You know, we had del cross E equals something, and del dot E equals something. And if you didn't satisfy that, you weren't an electromagnetic field. Well, the Ten Commandments say, thou shalt not kill, but people kill all the time. Thou shalt not steal, people steal all the time. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. I've never done that, but I read that people do that. All this says is, basically, you shouldn't kill, you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't covet thy neighbor's wife, you shouldn't, whatever this one is, the firstling of an ass, thou shalt redeem. Somebody actually caught me on this and said, that is not a Ten Commandment. It's commandment number 24 in the Decalogue, of which the first 10 are the usual ones. But I looked up a Wiki article on the Ten Commandments, and it included it. So I thought, well, if Wiki can include it, I shall include it as well. Okay, notice how the readings of this notion of law are different. Like I say, people kill all the time. It's just saying, I recommend that you not do that. Well, you know, sometimes people, very religious people, say, well, I know I'm going to hell if I kill. So they know there's going to be a bad outcome. In some sense, but maybe they still kill anyway because they care more about their family than they do about their own soul. And maybe it's necessary, you know, to protect one's children to kill. So these are recommendations. Well, similarly, I want to think of the Born Rule as something like a recommendation. It's a recommendation for how you should gamble, how you should gamble consistently. So let me try to put a little meat on those bones and tell you what I'm talking about. It has to do with the at least one Bayesian definition of probability, something called the Dutch book rule for defining what probability means. So here's what we're going to mean by probability. If I have a bookie who declares some odds for something, or let's say he declares probabilities, he puts up a list of these things by probabilities, what he's doing is saying that he will sell a ticket that's worth $1 for this amount. Worth $1 for this. So if E occurs, then you get $1 from him. If E doesn't occur, he keeps all the money you've given to him. And the definition, the very definition of probability, is that declaring a probability P sub E for some event means that one will buy or sell a lottery ticket of this structure for this amount. So when you're declaring a probability, you're declaring a price for a lottery ticket. And that's all. That's the full definition of probability from this point of view. To get the structure of probability theory, then, so this is the definition of a probability. To get the structure of probability theory, you have to add a little bit more, and we're going to add a little bit more. It's a normative rule. Never declare probabilities. Never declare these prices for tickets in such a way that they will lead to a sure loss for you. So this is of the structure of a recommendation. The meaning of probability is how much you will buy and sell tickets for, but there's a recommendation. You should never price your tickets in such a way that it will lead to a sure loss on one gamble. So let me give you some examples of how this normative rule, if you accept it, puts some structures on probabilities. Suppose you try to set a negative price on a ticket. So we have a negative number. You have PE that's less than zero, then the very meaning of that is that the bookie will sell the ticket for negative money. In other words, he'll give you a ticket and he'll say, here, take some money with it. Well, then, of course, you will lose money. That will be a sure loss. So this normative requirement tells you that you had better pick positive numbers for these tickets. Example two. Suppose that you set a price that's larger than one for a ticket. Then, by definition, the bookie will buy the ticket for more than it's worth. So, you know, he says, please give me a ticket that will pay off $1. I'll give you $2 for it. Well, he's already had a sure loss. So tickets had never better be priced with a number that's greater than one. Of course, this is a recommendation. If you want to be really stupid, you can break these rules in the same way that you can break the Ten Commandments. Here, I'll give you one more example. You guys know this rule of probability, that the probability, if E and F are mutually exclusive, then the probability of E or F has to equal the probability of E plus the probability of F. Well, the very meaning of this symbol is the price that one would buy or sell a ticket of this structure worth $1 if E or F. Alternatively, the very definitions of these guys is the price one will buy or sell a ticket if E and the price of F. But clearly, the payoff of this ticket is exactly the payoff of these two tickets. So you had better adjust your prices so that you pay the same amount for these two tickets as for that ticket. So it's a recommendation. If you want to be stupid, you don't have to follow this rule. A good piece of the quantum Bayesian program, as I've already said, is to say that the Born rule is kind of like this. So let me just go to how it could possibly be like this. I should have said I'm going to kill three birds with one stone rather than two, as you'll see in a little bit. Because today I want to propose an experiment. That's for you, not for the students. And it has to do with this. It has to do with this way of looking at the Born rule. So how can we start to see the Born rule as a normative construction? Well, the easiest way to start seeing it that way, I think, is to get rid of the language of quantum states and put in their place the language of probabilities from the outset. And for those, I think, oh, by the way, who is Ian Hinks? You're Ian. And who is Jesse Wright? Okay. I have faces for the names that have written me now. Some of you guys came to yesterday's lecture, and I used this picture, but some of you didn't, so let me tell you about it. Here's the way I'm going to get rid of quantum states. Imagine in the Bureau of Standards in Paris, there's not only the standard kilogram and the standard meter stick, but there's something that I'll call a standard quantum measurement. What I'd like is a measurement that's so powerful and so nice that if you knew the probabilities for the outcomes, if you were to take this quantum system up to it and drop it in, if you knew those probabilities and those probabilities alone, you'd be able to reconstruct the quantum state. I'd like a measurement like that. Well, luckily, the notion of a positive operator valued measurement is good enough for this sort of thing. You can't do this with a standard von Neumann measurement, but if you choose the right POVM, then you can do this sort of thing. You can find a POVM such that if you know the probabilities for the outcomes, these P of H's, think of the outcomes as H, if you were to take this system up here, that would completely tell you what the quantum state rho is. You can get rid of quantum states at that point and just use probabilities. Why this is nice for this project is if you now consider some other measurement device, not the one in the Bureau of Standards, but something that could be built in a laboratory like in this building, if there are laboratories here, aren't there? I guess there are. So just some other kind of measurement. Then what it's telling you is that the way you calculate the probabilities for this measurement, probabilities for the outcomes of this measurement, is from the probabilities for the outcomes of this measurement. So instead of the Born rule as being this exotic thing that takes this exotic object, a quantum state that lives in a complex vector space, and transforms it into a probability. From this point of view, the Born rule is just a rule for transforming from one probability distribution to another probability distribution. So now the story of quantum mechanics is you put probabilities in and you get probabilities out. You don't put an exotic object, a matrix, over a complex vector space and get probabilities out. You put probabilities in, you put probabilities out. You get probabilities out. The question now is, what measurement should we use for this Bureau of Standards? And this is where the group of guys that you saw, and one girl, at the beginning, this is basically the bread and butter research right now, is trying to unlock the structure of the very special measurement, something called a SEEK, which stands for Symmetric Informationally Complete. Suppose you have D squared projection operators. So we've got a Hilbert space of dimension D. Suppose you've got D squared rank one dimensional projection operators, such that if you take the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product between any two of them, you get a constant number. So you've just got a set of vectors in the vector space of operators that have, you know, uniform inner products between each other. They're very uniformly spread. Then you can show that such a set has to be a set of linearly independent operators, and they have to sum up to the identity, or something proportional to the identity. Well, this one means that you can use those set of operators as the outcomes of a POVM. You did lecture on POVMs, didn't you? Okay. So if we have a set of operators that satisfy this, we can use them as a measuring device. And because they're all linearly independent, and there's D squared of them, they span the space of operators, so they form a basis for the space of operators, which ultimately means if I have a density operator of any variety, if I have a quantum state of any variety, there should be some expansion of it in terms of these basis states. And the nice thing about these particular guys, the one with this structure, is that you can calculate the expansion coefficients, and they turn out to be very simply related to the probabilities of the outcomes of this measurement. So if you know the probabilities for the outcome of such a measurement, you can calculate the quantum state and vice versa. And the formula is almost trivial, really nice. There. So for a qubit, if you just think in terms of the Bloch sphere, all you're trying to find is a regular tetrahedron. And, you know, there's a continuous infinity of regular tetrahedra that you can fit in the Bloch sphere. And those four guys, we need D squared, those four guys correspond to the outcomes of such a measurement. Here's another example in dimension three. You take the third root of the identity, and then you can construct this very nice set. And that's an example for a Q-trit. But don't get lulled by looking at these very pretty and simple solutions, because as soon as you get past dimension three, the only known ones are really difficult and complicated ones. For instance, this is dimension six. So in dimension six, we would need 36 vectors, six squared. We'd need 36 vectors. And this is just one vector of the 36 I thought I would display. The only one of the 36 that I know, because our friend Marcus Appleby, who was in the picture, spent some weeks calculating this by hand, and he got it in its simplest possible form. So actually, here's the experiment I want to propose right here. And I'll tell you why maybe a little bit later. But there's something special about dimension 36. This measurement, this 36 outcome measurement, would be the optimal measurement for doing quantum tomography. Now, usually when people want to do optimal quantum tomography, they introduce a complete set of mutually unbiased bases. So for instance, for a qubit, you would measure spin in the x direction, spin in the y direction, and spin in the z direction, and you can show that the statistics of your measurement outcomes converge to an estimate of the quantum state as fast as they can. So a complete set of mutually unbiased bases is optimal for tomography in dimension two. The SEEK, the one that I showed you a bit earlier, that guy is also optimal for quantum tomography in dimension 2. And there's some little nicety about it. It has, instead of having 6 possible outcomes, because you're measuring 3 bases, it has 4 outcomes, so it has a smaller number of outcomes. So the statistics converge just as fast, but they do it with a smaller data supply in the sense of the number of outcomes in each possible slot. But that's not a great trade-off.
So by optimal, you mean the number of repetitions of the experiment?
That's right. That's right. So if you want to estimate the state to within some epsilon, and you ask how many, within that you're getting it right to within some epsilon, and you ask how many samples do I have to take before I'm within the epsilon, then both this guy and a complete set of mutually unbiased bases are optimal.
And does that proof depend in any way on what reconstruction method you use, if it's maximum likelihood or...
Yeah, it does. It does. And I don't remember the details of the particular... Well, no, it's a little robust in the sense that I've seen people do it by 2 different measures of optimality. And at least for those 2 measures, both seeks and MUBs are optimal. And in dimension 3, it's the same thing again. In fact, there's this language that Robin has probably told you guys about, of the language of 2 designs. Any 2 design is an optimal measurement for tomography, in the sense of Andrew Scott, in the sense of Bernie Yerke, and Wooters and Fields as well. So similarly, that's the case for dimension 3. This would be an optimal measurement for tomography. A complete set of MUBs would be optimal for tomography. But something gets interesting in dimension 6. And the thing that gets interesting in dimension 6 is that it doesn't appear that a complete set of MUBs exist. So they can't be optimal, assuming they don't exist. No one's ever been able to find such a set. So you would need 7 bases, each with 6 outcomes. They don't exist, but this one does. So this would be a case where the seeks really are a more powerful object than MUBs.
Other 2 designs in 6 that aren't MUBs?
They're known to exist with really big numbers of outcomes. Yeah. They're known to exist. Whether they've ever been constructed, I don't know, and I don't think so.
How would the seek approach compare with measuring the Heisenberg-Weil operators? Well, I guess that wouldn't work. They're not Hermitian, but...
Yeah, they're not Hermitian.
Yeah.
I just wanted to throw that on the table. That's not so much about foundations, but we could talk about this later. All right. Well, here's what really is known about these things. By analytic construction, they're known to exist in dimension 2 through... Oh, that's an old transparency. They're known to exist in dimension 2 through 15, 19, 24, 35, and 48, I think. And by numerical work, they're known to exist out to dimension 67. Throw these facts out, because much of what I'm going to say now depends upon their existence. Quantum mechanics, I would say, looks very nice if they exist. I can write the Born rule as an obvious sort of normative rule. If they don't exist, then there's something wrong with this foundational idea of mine. So there's some technical work to be done, and one of the things Professor Laflamme wanted me to emphasize is that there can be technical work in quantum foundations, not just wordy work. And this is a big piece of the Cubist program, is trying to show that such structures always exist. And if they do exist, what things do they tell you? And I'll show you some of those. I just wanted to show one last thing about these things, and that is that they actually can be constructed. Here is an example of a Q-trit that Ephraim Steinberg's group has worked on. They've built this device where they measure something that approaches something like a seek. So in principle, it would. What they have is an optical cavity. They encode their Q-trit on 2 possible polarizations in one path and 1 possible polarization in the second path. And the way this thing works is if there were no losses, or effectively no losses, and we could send the single photon around and around and around, at the end of time, then we would have 9 possible outcomes, and it would correspond to a Q-trit seek. But there are so many losses in this system that the photon can go around about 3 times before it's eaten up. So one finds a very asymmetric structure. And if you throw in the theory of the losses, then it looks very symmetric. But if you don't throw in the theory of the losses, then you get a very asymmetric sort of thing.
If I may. So one thing that, so a sick POVM is what I call an improper POVM, which means that you need extra quantum resources to implement it. So if you think of it in the Steinspring sense, you actually have to dilate it, or the Nyemark theorem sense. To implement some POVMs, you need to actually do a PVM on a bigger quantum system. It's not enough to do a PVM on the system alone and add classical randomness. So is that, are you with me?
Well, I'm with you, but I have a philosophical difference.
Well, but the point is, in terms of philosophy or not, philosophical problems or not, the point is, from an experimental point of view, it matters. Because, for example, in NMR, where you can have a d-dimensional quantum system, they can't do a sick POVM.
Yeah.
Right? They can only do proper PVMs. So it's a practical distinction rather than a philosophical one for me. And so my question is, what is playing the role of the extra quantized resource? Is it the cavity? Because you need an extra quantum degree of freedom to do this. So
I'm not used to analyzing that. I think that maybe the Steinspring theorem is misleading. Because what the Steinspring theorem says is there is always a way to think of a POVM as dilating to a larger Hilbert space and performing a regular projective valued measure. But that theorem is much of the same flavor as anytime you have a mixed state, there is always a way to think of it as a partial trace over a pure state.
But here's the difference, actually. So I discussed this in my lectures, is that for density operators, they can always be thought of either in a Steinspring sense or they can be thought of as a mixture.
Yeah.
But what's different about CP maps and POVMs, and this is the reason why I think taking the generalized axioms as fundamental is mistaken, that's not true. There are some improper POVMs which can't be expressed as convex combinations of PVMs, which means that you need more than a d-dimensional quantum system to implement them.
I think there's an aspect of what you just expressed about it being mistaken that is mistaken.
Well, anyways, the point is, if we analyze this, there's going to be another, if they're doing a sick POVM, then there's for sure going to be another quantized system.
My usual defense to this is people say, oh, POVMs are secondary because I always need to think of a larger Hilbert space and a regular PVM on the larger Hilbert space. And then to them, as I will to you, I'll say, okay, so what constitutes one of these measurements? How do you know when you've done one? What's the theory of them? The whole point we have Quantum Foundations meetings and the whole point we have Quantum Foundations courses is because we don't think we understand what the hell a measurement is. So what you've done is you've taken this structure that we don't know what the hell is and you've turned it into another structure that we don't know what the hell it is, namely, you know, measurements of this variety. We don't really know how these things come about. So my philosophical difference with you is if we're going to have some spot where we're going to say, don't know what the hell it is, you can stop at either place. You can stop at POVMs and say, don't know what the hell it is, or you can stop at PVMs and say, don't know what the hell it is. Either way, you don't know what the hell something is.
My claim to you is to do a sick POVM on a d-dimensional quantum system, what is required operationally is the capability to perform a unitary operation, a repeatable unitary operation, on a system coupled to another quantum system. If you don't have the control to implement unitary transformations, but only do classical transformations on systems larger than d dimensions, then you can't do a sick POVM. So that's a totally practical operational criterion. Has nothing to do with philosophy.
Since I'm on the stage, I'll have the last word in this one.
Okay.
And I'll ask you, what is a von Neumann measurement? And the usual story is, oh, we take this basis, and we have a unitary transformation that entangles this system with another system. That's the usual story. It's not my story, but that's the usual story. If you buy that hook, line, and sinker, then right there you've got a unitary transformation that's required even for a von Neumann measurement.
That's required for an
I was going to have the last word.
That's required. Okay, well, anyways, there's an answer to that, if you're interested.
Okay, so if these things exist...
The question there, which is not from a student Emerson.
I want to be a student in this class.
Yes.
So two questions. These six are not unique up to a unitary orienting term, I mean for...
No, they're not unique.
Can you speak louder?
And so his question was, are these Sikhs equivalent up to a unitary operation or an anti-unitary operation? So in other words, if I give you two Sikhs, is there always some unitary operation that takes you from one to the other? Or is there some anti-unitary operation that takes you from one to the other? And the answer is no. Now, in dimension two, all Sikhs are regular tetrahedra. Regular tetrahedrons. That is tetrahedra. Okay. Yeah. So you can transform any one Sikh into another by unitary transformation in dimension two. In dimension three, you can't. In fact, there's a one-parameter family of inequivalent Sikhs, once it can't be transformed into each other, in dimension three.
So even if six exists, then there's no unique representation of quantum states. I mean, there's no one preferred representation.
Not that I know of. But they're all rotations of each other. So they're all rotations in the big operator space. So you can always rotate one into the other, but you have to step outside of the cone of positive operators for a bit of the rotation, and then you come back into it.
Another question. If someone proves that six doesn't exist in arbitrary dimension, what does it mean for you?
Yeah. It means that there's some aspect of this program that doesn't lead to as pretty of a representation as I want it to. Of a flavor, it does. So everything that I said in yesterday's lecture that you were at remains true. One still has a catalog of reasons for thinking that quantum states are like probability distributions. And moreover, one doesn't need the Sikhs to get a representation of quantum states as probabilities. If you introduce any informationally complete measurement and put it in the Bureau of Standards, it would be good for making the mapping from quantum states to probabilities. So in principle, you can always get rid of operators. Okay? All of that stands. If Sikhs don't exist, then the Born rule will not take on as pretty and simple of a form as I'm about to show. So what does that do? It means that there's one thing that's not as pretty as it might have been about the program. But I think, the program stands for all of the reasons that I presented yesterday. Okay, so you get a mapping if these guys exist. But the mapping, of course, it has to be, the mapping is one-to-one as I claimed, but it's not necessarily, it is not onto. So what that means is that when I map from a quantum state to the probability simplex, it picks out a point. But there are points in the probability simplex that don't correspond to quantum states. Particularly, the convex set of density operators has to get mapped into a convex set on the probability simplex. The thing about the Sikhs is it makes the shape, this convex shape, just as pretty and as simple as it can possibly be. What is the shape? Well, the shape is given by the pure states. If you know where the pure states land in the simplex, then you know everything about the whole convex object. And you can check the conditions for having a pure state. If you take an arbitrary probability and put it into the formula that we used before, you'll get a Hermitian operator generally, but you won't necessarily get a positive semi-definite operator. So you have a Hermitian operator for an arbitrary probability. The condition for a Hermitian operator to be a pure state, one way of writing it, is to demand that the trace of the operator squared and the trace of the operator cubed equals 1. When you translate this condition into a statement about the simplex, it means that pure states live on a sphere of a certain size. That's what the one condition states. And furthermore, satisfy a certain kind of quadratic constraint that depends upon the Sikhs. And this thing, to go back to your question, this set of numbers will depend upon the particular Sikh, so they'll change. But this defines a certain shape on the probability simplex. And if you allow yourself a rotation outside of the probability simplex and back into it, it's just a rotation of the shape. So there's a certain invariance here that's not exactly expressed by this tensor of numbers. Okay, so the only point of this is This picture is equivalent to Hilbert space if you know the shape. And since it's equivalent to Hilbert space if you know the shape, these two equations contain the sum content of what Hilbert space is from this point of view. Hilbert space is a restriction, is isomorphic to a restriction on the probability simplex of a certain type. I have in purple down here, could these be independently motivatable physical constants? Let me show you what I mean by that. What I'm wondering is, can one take some simple idea and get the structure of these constants back from the simple idea? And here's the simple idea. And one of the reasons I'm so keen on these seeks. Suppose there's some measurement that you want to perform. I'll call this the measurement on the ground and this the measurement in the sky because of the way they're situated. Suppose there's some measurement on the ground that you want to perform that's some von Neumann measurement. You're going to throw this quantum system into this measurement. It will generate a click J. And the question is, what's the probability for the outcomes D sub J for this guy? Well, if you know the quantum state and you know which von Neumann measurement you're talking about, then you can calculate it by the usual Born rule. But I'm not going to give you that. Instead, I'm going to give you this. I'm going to give you the probabilities for the outcomes of a seek. We already know that that's equivalent to stating the quantum state. But moreover, I'm going to give you the probabilities, the conditional probabilities. If you perform this seek up here and get a click I, H sub I, the probability for getting D sub J down here is given by some conditional probability. What I want to know is, do these two pieces of data, this probability distribution, and this class of probability distributions, do they uniquely specify what I'm going to get if I don't go the imaginary route, but instead I go the real route? I'd like to know that. Is this enough data to get the number that I really want? What happens if I throw it this way, rather than throwing it up into the sky and then letting it fall down? Well, one thing you can already guess is that you cannot use the usual rules of probability. And you can put that in common kind of language. Common language is, these probabilities for getting the outcome if you go this route won't be the same as if you had gone that route, because this process breaks the coherence in the quantum state. People say things like that. So what I'm saying is, it's not the case that you use the usual law of probability, law of total probability, that the probability of DJ is equal to this sum, which is no great surprise. And Joseph Emerson's professor, his PhD professor, wrote a nice paper explaining why this is the case in 86 or so. And other people had done it before. But here's the main point. You get an inequality here simply because you're comparing two different experiments. One experiment is throwing it directly into the measurement on the ground, and the other experiment is throwing it into the measurement in the sky and then letting it fall to the ground. So there's extra conditions on these probabilities, and it makes it the case then that you wouldn't have this, because this is really with reference to experiment one, and these are with respect to experiment two. What's nice, though, about the seek is that you almost get to reinstate the old classical law. You almost get to ignore the conditions. In particular, you get this simple modification of it. The quantum probability, the one for going the route on the ground, is given by the old classical one and then just a small linear transformation on it that depends upon the dimension of the Hilbert space. So let me just show that again. You do the old classical calculation, and then you just feed it into a little linear device, and that gives the quantum outcome. So that suggests, that's so pretty, maybe this expression, this modification to the law of total probability, captures whatever quantum mechanics is trying to tell us. So I want to ask this question, and we've been working on this for some time. Could we take the diagram that I showed you and this modification to the law of total probability and use it as a fundamental postulate of quantum mechanics. Well, what would it have to give us if it were a fundamental postulate of quantum mechanics? Well, from this view, all it really has to give us is some reason for that shape. So if this modification to the law of total probability can give us a reason for restricting the simplex and giving us the shape, then we've gotten quantum mechanics out of it. Well, how could it possibly do that? Well, here's the way. Suppose you postulate that this has to be true for any experiment that you can perform on the ground. Then you want these numbers on the left-hand side to be actual probabilities. They should be between 0 and 1. If they're not, you're doing something stupid in the Dutch book sense of probability. So they should be between 0 and 1, and they should sum up to 1. Well, because of the form of this law, that automatically places restrictions on this sum. Because if this sum were to be very close to 0, then we would have something times 0 minus 1, so we'd get a negative number. Alternatively, this sum can't be too large. If it's too large, then we get d plus 1 times something, let's say that's larger than, well, let's say it got close to 1, then we'd get d plus 1 here minus 1, that would be d, and d is always larger than 1. So just demanding this rule automatically places a restriction on what these probabilities can be. If you add just a little bit more structure, namely that there exist measurements on the ground for which you can have certainties for the outcomes, you can prove a little theorem that says this. Any two points in the set that I've shown you, within the shape, it has to be the case that if you take their inner products, the inner product between the two probability functions can't be too small and it can't be too large. So all of a sudden, you now have a continuously infinite set of quadratic inequalities. And it's this sort of thing that leads us, or me at least, I don't know about you guys, maybe you don't believe anything I say, leads me to believe that maybe one can get this ultimately quadratic structure. Here I wrote it as a quadratic equation and a cubic equation, but I could have written it as a set of coupled quadratic equations just by demanding that rho squared equals rho rather than trace rho squared equals trace rho cubed equals 1. So ultimately, there's some kind of quadratic structure built into this, and we're seeing that the quantum state space, if we take the Born rule as a fundamental postulate in this language, is a set of quadratic inequalities, continuous infinity of them. So the homework problem for everyone is, suppose you have a set with this kind of structure, S. It has the structure that I was just saying. I'm going to call it consistent. If for any two points within S, the inner product is not too small and not too large, that's one assumption. A further one is that if you add any further point to this S, then it would make it inconsistent in this sense. In other words, I have a set that's maximal. If I try to add one more point to it within the probability simplex, then it has to violate this inequality with one other one. Suppose I take this structure, maximal consistent sets. One can show that the set of quantum states is consistent and maximal. And your homework problem is characterize all such guys and compare them to quantum and see whether further axioms have to be added. But I'll show you how a little bit of structure already just comes from this definition, and then I'm going to quit and we'll start taking questions. Oh, Jesus, I've gone too long. Here's one. That has to be true for any Q and any P, the inequalities that I showed you before. So take Q equal to P. Then it tells you that P dot P has to be less than or equal to this number. I don't know if you remember that number, but for pure states, P dot P had to equal that number. So automatically you get that all the valid probability distributions have to lie within a sphere of just the right size. That's point number one. Point number two is, suppose you have a subset within one of these S's, one of these maximal consistent S's. And suppose, so we've got these points P sub K, suppose there are M of them. And let us further suppose that we saturate both ends of the bound, that pk dot pk is equal to the upper bound, and pk dot pl, when k is not equal to l, is equal to the lower bound. So in other words, I'm trying to make these points as distant as they can be from each other, given this constraint. How many such guys can I satisfy these two constraints for? And you can prove a little bound that says there can be no more than d of them. So you start to get Hilbert space structure back. You started with probabilities that live in a space of size d squared, and you ask how many of them can be maximally distant from each other, and you find the quantum mechanical answer, d, just from that little bit of structure. So I'll leave you with that. What further postulates must we add to make this precisely quantum state space? In other words, to get back the set of this structure. And I don't really know the answer, but I thought I'd tell you something about the technical program, and this is the technical program. If I have more money next year, I'll have more money for at least one more student without an insert grant. So keep me in mind if you're interested in this stuff. Thanks. I'll take questions now. Chris.
So how ugly is the formula if you just had a general two still RA?
How ugly is the invisibility in the staircase? Who painted that?
So only many of the students here don't know what the design is.
Okay, so instead of a seat, if you had just some other information to complete, you'll be in a has nice properties. How much does it deviate from the prettiness?
That's a good question. And what I was trying to express is that it's surely aesthetic. You know how ugly it really is. I mean, so you two guys have these papers about all possible such expressions, and you get something that you call a distorted law of total probability, is that what you call it?
Deform.
A deform.
That's how pretty.
So already there, you're giving a bit of a value judgment.
Well, we said different from.
You meant different from.
But yours is deformed too by that.
Yeah, mine is deformed too. The difference is that you guys, you're going to have to correct me. Maybe Chris, you should come write this. So here's the one that I was showing off is something like this. P of dj is given by some constant, d plus 1, times the old law of total probability. I don't know why I said old very longly. So part of the prettiness of this for me is that it isolates one piece that is definitely the old law of total probability. It says, here it is, and I just take the old calculation and I modify it. I deform the result of the old law of total probability. What you guys deform is actually the law of total probability itself, if that makes sense. You end up with something that looks like an extra sum over I and K with a matrix in here of J, K, P, H, I. Is this right? One of you who can judge? There are two authors on the paper. I think this is what you get most generally for any informationally complete.
I need a K
in here, I think. Yeah. So in some formal way, this looks a bit like the old law of total probability. I mean, it takes probabilities as inputs and conditional probabilities and returns me a final probability. So it has that much of the same flavor. It looks like this. Now, is that ugly or not? Well, it's not necessarily ugly. The only point about this one is that it gave me a simple way to start thinking of where this wacky shape comes from. I could just say, oh, you know, first off, I can see that this term can't be too large or too small. And here, you know, it's just not so obvious. So it's just a question of aesthetics. I think, you know, if the Sikhs don't work, if they don't exist, then I'll definitely retreat to one of these. But when I retreat to one of these, then I'll say, let me try to make it as pretty as possible. Let me choose as a measurement in the Bureau of Standards the ones that make the matrix MJK as symmetric as possible. I mean, the thing, all that's going on up here is that the metric MJ, I mean, excuse me, the matrix MJK is of this form, that it's, this doesn't work. It's got something down the diagonal, and it's got the same things on the off diagonal. So it's got like A, and B everywhere else. So that's as symmetric as it can possibly be. If a Sikh doesn't exist, then I can't have such a symmetric matrix, but I might have something that's relatively symmetric. Did that answer your question?
If you had more money, would you pay a student to investigate this before you found an answer?
I don't know. Actually, if I take on another student, it's because I'm dreaming of getting it. Who knows whether I'll get it, but I'm dreaming of getting a Templeton grant. And I think I might want a student who does more conceptual and less technical sorts of things. That was the sort of thing I was thinking. But that didn't answer your question. Matthew?
Oh, someone else had a question?
Yesterday afternoon, someone asked about how you read hydrogen atom in this sort of framework. Where did you think of international systems fit into this?
Repeat my question.
Yeah, it's a good question. Where do infinite dimensional systems fit into this picture? Because I defined a Sikh in finite dimensional Hilbert space. One should ask the question, do they generalize to infinite dimensions? And I have no idea whether they do or not. And I think that there are probably some indications that maybe they don't generalize to infinite dimensions. Now, one can look on this as a great defeat, or one can look on it as an opportunity. And you know which way I lean, that maybe this is telling us something interesting. At least in my own case, it has caused me to take these holographic principles that we hear at PI a lot more seriously. There the statement is that for a region of space of a certain size and a certain energy, there's a bound on the entropy that amount of space can have. And it's caused me to wonder whether there's really a bound on the Hilbert space dimension associated with that space. In other words, maybe in actual fact, in nature, there are no infinite... If the holographic principle is true, I'm guessing that there are really no infinite dimensional spaces, infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. No, we've gone to at least 67 already. And I'm older than 42, so so we've got two things that have surpassed that bound. Maybe we're not Hilbert space dimensions. I don't know. That's just speculation. I met the fellow. So who asked about two designs? Somebody said something about two designs. Chris Ferry asked about two designs. So I didn't tell you what a two design is. Let me just quickly tell you. Do we have a better one than this? Oh, I'll use it. Nah, it's okay. So a two design is, suppose you have some projection operators, pi I, that are rank one, psi I. Yes. Sometimes they're called complex projective two designs. But here's what I mean by these things, is that if I have a set of these, and if I form the sum I, pi I, tensor pi I, if this is proportional to the projection operator onto the symmetric subspace, then such a set is called a state two design. Well, this diagram that I draw and this law of this law of total probability that I drew there actually would be true for any one of these kinds of designs. So I don't really need a seek to get this, and I guess I did hide this in the presentation. But what's special about the seek is it defines a state space, a convex set, that is the same dimensionality as the space of... Oh, maybe that's why you asked this question. I'm sorry. Yes, I started talking about more general things other than two designs. Yeah. Yeah, so you'll just get the same formula, actually, for any two design. But the difference is there'll be a discrepancy in the size of the simplex versus the state space. So you still get a very pretty formula in some way, but I'm quite convinced that it leads to a more complicated structure when you try to just use inequalities to pin down the state space structure, because you have to end up with a set of measure zero. Instead of a set of full measure, you have to end up with a set of measure zero, a convex set within a subspace. Why did we bring this up? It was related to someone else's question about something else, was it? Oh, Matthews. Yes. Okay. I was lucky enough to meet one of the inventors of the idea of a seek, a guy named Gerhard Zauner in Vienna a couple of weeks ago or a month ago. And he was telling me that he believes that there are two designs with order d cubed elements, not d squared, that do generalize all the way up to the infinite dimensional case. So along the lines of the retreat, that, you know, if I had to retreat from here, you know, I'd do it. But you're right. I would, if I had to retreat from here for seeks, I would retreat to this same thing, but with state two designs that have more elements, if I could. Complete sets of MUBs are no good because they don't seem to exist in all dimensions. So it might have to be something like Zauner talks about. The existence bounds are no, they're higher order. That one can, so you had it in one of your papers. That in all finite dimensions, it's known that finite two designs exist. And there's an estimate on how many states you need in those. And it's larger than d cubed, I think.
Big enough that I ignored, didn't memorize the number.
Yeah, it's some number. It may be on the order of d to the fourth. That you can guarantee that one always exists if you allow yourself d to the fourth states. I think it's on that order, because I believe that when I was talking to Zauner and he told me that he thought that there are these d cubed designs that generalize all the way up to the infinite dimensional case, I remember thinking, that would beat the best known bounds that you had written about. In
the direct generalization of the classical two designs on spheres, right? And just because quantum state space is just a hypersphere. So that's all we did for that part of the paper. This is the paper with Ambinus, I assume you're thinking of.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and you just cite the result. It was somebody else's result.
It was a trivial translation in the quantum setting.
Okay.
Some guy from California, I forget his name.
Okay.
I have a very basic question. I'm still trying to understand the main statements that in this program, that quantum state doesn't exist or probability doesn't exist. I'm just trying to understand that. So if you perform, for example, a Schrenger-Lac measurement in z direction, you measure some spin z, then everybody agrees that that state, I mean, everybody assigned the same state to the quantum system after that measurement. And then if you perform a measurement in X direction, with 50-50 probability, you get up and down. So in this sense, probability is, this 50-50 probability is as objective as any other physical quantity, like mass of electron or any other physical quantity. So I still don't understand why you can say it's just a...
Yes, I understand the question. I'm searching my mind for how to respond optimally. If I had a coin in my pocket, and I pulled it out, and I flipped it, and I flip it and I hold on to it and I don't look at it, my guess is that Joseph and I would both say there's a 50-50 chance that it's heads or tails. So, did that make the probability objective in that case? Well, maybe Luke there has a little device in his shoe, as some fellows walked into a gambling house in somewhere once. These guys are really clever. They put a little computer in their shoe and had a wire running up to their glasses, and on the glasses they had a little thing that could take a snapshot or get a quick fix on when the roulette ball was released, and then it would do a little calculation and it would change the probabilities just a tiny amount, but it was enough to give these guys an advantage over the gambling house. And the reason for that is because the probability is not an objective state of affairs in that case. In other words, if you walk to the coin, if you could imagine talking to the coin and you say, what's your probability of falling heads? The coin would laugh at you. And he'd say, I'm falling heads. I know exactly what I'm doing. Right? If you knew the initial conditions, then you would be able to say exactly how the coin is going to fall. So the fact that one ascribes probabilities means that in this case, one has incomplete information. One doesn't know exactly how the coin was launched. Now, in the quantum case, people get the feeling that there's something different going on. And that's what you were trying to express. That if we do this Stern-Gerlach device, everybody will say that if we got the one outcome and then we did the other, it would be 50-50. Everyone would say that. And the way you express it makes it seem like that is indeed obvious. But when we being Carlton Caves and Rudiger Schock and myself, started to take the strong Bayesian stance on quantum probabilities, Caves was saying things like you, and to some extent he still does every now and then. And he would say, you can't tell physicists that when you walk into their lab, this is not a beam splitter. If it's a 50-50 beam splitter, everybody will know it's a 50-50 beam splitter, which is a kind of example of what you were just talking about. But that was the way he expressed it, 50-50 beam splitters. So the cool thing was I went to Hideo Mabuchi, and I said, if you walked into one of Kimball's labs, he wasn't the professor yet, and you saw all this optical stuff on the table, would you know exactly what kind of beam splitter you had? And he said, no, of course not. Okay, what's the point of this long story told in an old man fashion? It's that in order to get a statement about what probabilities will arise in some sufficiently complex system, like one of Kimball's optical tables, if you've ever seen these things, they're amazingly complex, you would have to do a lot of calibration. You would have to get inside, tinker with the apparatus. You would have to make measurements yourself. You would have to do statistical updating that depended upon prior probabilities. If you're a Bayesian about regular probabilities, then when you do these things called tomography, you have to invoke priors and blah, blah, blah. So you find that there's a long chain of probabilities that you have used before you ever make your probability one statements or your statement that if I saw this, then I will see that with probability one half. Well, since I don't know how to cleanly isolate one probabilistic statement from all the rest that led up to that probabilistic statement, all the probabilistic statements I had to use in calibrating my equipment, in doing quantum tomography, those all involve probabilistic statements to begin with. They all depend upon priors. I don't know how to cut out the quantum piece and say, this one is not prior dependent. It's an objective probability that doesn't depend upon any of the priors in the background that led up to it.
I guess I don't see these priors. In this simple example, you can say, I have this beam splitter, and then I rotate that 90 degree, and then I'm sure it's 50-50.
Oh, you say it's a simple example, but that's because you're not really imagining all the deformities in the magnets, and you're not imagining all of the real-world stuff that the experimentalist has to deal with on a daily basis. You have an ideal diagram in your mind of a little magnet that's cut geometrically perfectly, and that if you found an up in this direction, and now you rotate it. But no real-world magnet is like that. And so the claim is that the conversation with Mabuchi is an extreme case of actually the same thing. That you can't just say, I walk in and I look at it and I know the probabilities. Not in the real world. In some example where you say, assume probability, a prior probability of this amount, do some calculations, I get a posterior probability of this amount. Then I say, well, what if the prior probability was wrong? Then you say, oh, okay, then the posterior probability will be wrong as well. Okay, we could do this in an ideal calculation. Well, so similarly, you got to click when you rotated it this way. And you say, everyone will agree with it when we turn it this way. Well, maybe not everyone will, because maybe one of these guys is a Maxwellian demon who can see all the little pits in the magnet. And he says, I don't have the same probabilities for the next case.
So I guess, if I may, the short answer then is that there's no beam splitter in the world that's 50-50. It's only going to be 50.012 to 49.088. And so if 50-50 is an objective probability, then it's objectively wrong in any realistic case.
Oh, that's not the same point, but that's a good one. I like that one. No, I like that one very much. So, yes, if 50-50 is an objective probability, and that in the real world, it would be objectively wrong almost always, where I quantify almost always with a probabilistic statement.
So there's a Bayesian in the end.
Oh, no, there's a Bayesian. There's clearly a Bayesian.
There's more questions over here. I'd like to hear from some of you.
Same problem when you measure mass of electron.
If you measure a mass, you're gonna be stuck with exactly the same the same problems you mentioned.
No, it's of a different variety. So, I'm gonna try to say, but I can't speak infinitely fast, nor can I think infinitely fast. It's funny, people get heated in foundational discussions. It's so fun. But I would say it's not of the same sense in that it is sensible and useful to posit the idea that of a system in front of me, posit that it has a mass, an intrinsic quantity that I'll call mass, that it possesses and it has nothing to do with me. It's a sensible thing to do because it doesn't seem to lead to any great conceptual difficulties. Whereas I would say with probability, it is not such a sensible thing to do to posit that it has an intrinsic number called a probability. Why? Well, in the classical world where we can say our probabilities are purely ignorance, then it's pretty easy to identify that there aren't any objective probabilities. Like in the case of the coin toss, I toss it, I toss it again, I toss it again, I toss it again. The reason we're getting different outcomes on every toss is because there are different initial conditions in the toss. And the reason I write down a 50-50 probability each time is because I have no clue what the initial conditions were. But if somebody did have a clue of what the initial conditions were, if somebody had better vision than me and could, you know, sense the initial position of momentum better than I could, maybe that person wouldn't write down a uniform 50-50 each time. Maybe he'd have a little better estimate each time. Okay, so in the classical world, I think it's pretty easy, and this is the whole reason for the Bayesian movement, to say, I mean, it's rather easy to justify the idea that there's no intrinsic quantity associated with a system that has the flavor of probability. Now, when we come to quantum mechanics, it looks like that somehow we're in a different situation. One feels that way, and I certainly felt that way for a long time. This is the end point of 15 years of changing my mind about all kinds of things in quantum mechanics. No, it certainly isn't the end point, because I know there are some things that I can't answer adequately to myself, for sure. Here, if one objectifies probabilities, I mean, it looks like quantum formalism pushes you to objectify probabilities, at least some of them, and say, well, they really are intrinsic properties, properties intrinsic to a quantum system. But if you do that, then you have the trouble that the probabilities, these objective probabilities, determine uniquely the quantum state. Like through one of these mappings that I showed you today. And if quantum states themselves are objective states of affairs, then all you have to do is start playing with bipartite examples to quickly convince yourself that there's action at a distance. You make a measurement here, and that causes you to write down a new quantum state over there. That quantum state is objective, because probabilities, some of these probabilities are objective. The quantum state is objective, so my action here has instantaneously changed some property accessible over there, because I have changed the objective probabilities for the outcomes of any further measurement over there. So all I'm trying to say is, if I objectify probabilities, it leads me to conceptual difficulties. If I objectify mass and say, oh, this thing really has a mass, I don't know it, and its mass has nothing to do with me, as far as I can tell, that doesn't lead to conceptual difficulties. So of your original question, why don't you just call everything subjective and say that nothing is real, I don't see any need for that. All I see a need for is to say that quantum states are not real. Quantum systems, I don't see any reason to say that they're not real. As far as I know, that doesn't lead me to conceptual difficulties. I mean, I'm working under the assumption that you're real, but I'm not working under the assumption that the quantum state that I have assigned to you, if I had done so, is something intrinsic to you. I'd rather say the quantum state that I assigned to you is something intrinsic to me, namely it captures all of the beliefs that I have about you. I mean, there is a certain similarity, though. I'm glad you did ask about it. That, you know, I can't infinitely measure a mass, and I can't infinitely measure a probability. So that is one similarity between the two issues. But the long-winded answer I gave you is that, as far as I can tell, there's no conceptual difficulty with supposing that it has a mass, independent of my knowledge. I can do that. It doesn't cause any troubles, as far as I can tell. But when I suppose something has a quantum state, independent of my knowledge, it does cause conceptual difficulties.
Cosmo?
The starting point is usually incorrect.
Augustine or Howard were being very careful in their language, what would be the differences between your point of view and his? Or, so what's imprecise in saying this, or what's wrong in saying, looking at this way? Is there any difference?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of difference. Well, there are two difficulties for me. So one is the way you just said, a preparation is everything that is statistically relevant. A state is everything that is statistically relevant about a preparation. How does one judge what is statistically relevant? That involves a probabilistic statement, I would say. So I would say, in just saying that, you sort of sweep under the rug the fact that probabilities as subjective degrees of belief were used in some way. And Howard is well aware of this sort of thing. Because this is his main argument. Howard Barnum is well aware of these sorts of things because this is his main argument for why the Everettian attempts of deriving the Born rule just sweep the problem under the rug. Because they say when we have a certain symmetry, then we must assign a certain probability. And Howard says, why must we, unless we judge that they're irrelevant? And at that point, our judgment is coming in. So, for instance, I've got you know, an event that happens at this point in time, an event that happens at this point in time, and I say, I judge the same probability for the outcomes of the two events. Well, I'm judging that this label on them, that one happened here and now and one happened there and later, I'm judging that that's irrelevant. That's a judgment. So that's the first thing, that the statement about statistically relevant is just hiding a personalist Bayesian statement at some level. The second thing that the second issue is something I don't like about this whole business of preparations, that a quantum state corresponds to an equivalence class of preparations. I mean, it's not only my beef with that idea, but Leslie Ballantyne also says this a lot, and I have a beef with that, is that I think it just removes the problem one step. So instead of saying, here, there's an objective property associated with this system, you say, no. A quantum state is not an objective property of that system. It's an objective property of this system, the preparation device. It's an objective feature of this device that it made that quantum state. And so to the extent that one, you see, it looks like you're making some progress because you've taken the quantum state off of there and you've put it into something that looks a little more ethereal, sounds a little more ethereal, preparation procedure. But if one assumes that all pieces, and this, and I usually do, that all pieces of the world obey all the same principles at every level, then all I've done is I've removed some objective property from this one to replace it over here. And I think that ultimately I'm left with all the same conceptual problems. So I think it's better to say, oh, let's just assume that this thing called a state is not an objective state of affairs to begin with. It's neither an objective state of affairs about the system, nor is it an objective state of affairs about this thing called the preparation device. It's just my prior. For whatever reason. Just like in any Bayesian problem, one starts with a prior, and then one does one's calculations. Quantum state is just my prior for all possible measurements that I might perform on this system. Now the quantum state is neither associated with that system, nor some bigger system. It's just associated with me. So that's the distinction. And of the convex operational people, actually this is, I believe, how Howard Barnum thinks of it. And in this paper that he's going to put on the archive pretty soon, he goes further into explaining this sort of stuff. So one main lesson is, in the convex operational approach, one could be a quantum Bayesian. Howard considers himself that. He doesn't think of preparation procedures as objective states of affairs. He thinks of them as priors.
You talked about writing part-time systems and how that
Oh, you mean in the paper?
Yeah.
Not in today's.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could comment on that. Is there any way that was leading?
What is the question? I don't understand the question. I know you've already asked it. Could you say it again?
You talked about how bipartite, how representing a wave function in bipartite field space leads to entanglement, and that if you were to do it in a bigger number of space, we might not see entanglement. Could you comment on that? You never really went to the other side.
Well, I tried to go where I wanted to go with it. So the example was, or the reason I used it, and actually this leads to one of Cosman's questions as well in his email. It seems to me that when one posits two systems, so within the structure of quantum mechanics, if you say, here's a system and here's a system, the rules of quantum mechanics say, oh, you associate a Hilbert space with this one, you associate a Hilbert space with this one, and you associate a Hilbert space with the whole. And the Hilbert space that you associate with the whole is constructed by taking the tensor product of the two. So the point I was just trying to make there is that you put the little symbol you put the big X right there to always remind yourself that there are two systems. Okay? Now, people who play with Bell inequalities and use the Bell type argument, they say, oh, suppose we start with some state on this whole thing that's an entangled state. And then they use Bell inequality violations to try to argue that an action on this system changes something about this system. Can't signal with it, but it changes something about this system. Well, I would say, if that's always the case, that if I jiggle you and it causes Professor Laflamme to laugh, then I'd say, well, there's really no good sense in which you're two distinct objects. You're just one object. And I was fooling myself by putting this marker of distinction in between in the first place. That's what I would say. I know Cosman has, and we'll talk about that later to some extent. But I would say, what we've done is convinced ourselves that we didn't really have two systems. We really had one system. So then my only point is, why is it that after I made my measurement here, I still leave this marker in place? Why didn't I just say, oh, there weren't two systems. There was one system. In the quantum mechanical formalism, then one would reasonably expect it just says, oh, you don't write the big tensor product. You just write a bigger H. There's just one big system there. But nonetheless, it seems to me that quantum mechanics always holds on to the conceptual distinction of the two systems. I think that's a little funny. It's not a logical argument. And of course, Cosman caught it, that it's not a logical argument. And when I gave the talk at the Piaf meeting, I said, here is my vague worry before I presented the idea. One can try to fix this up by making a distinction between the operational procedures that one can perform on this large system. Then maybe I only have access to this part of it at one time and that part of it at another time, even though intrinsically they're one system. But I don't really have a good reply for that other than it just looks fishy to me. Should we take one more or just quit? Thank you all. Thank you all. It's fun.